This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/marketplace.
Expectations are, of course, everything, and nowhere more so than on Wall Street. From American Public Media, this is Market Plan. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosendahl. It is Wednesday, today, the 17th day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I'm going to give you a data point or two to get us going today, and then, well, we're just going to riff a little bit, all right? Target reported quarterly results this morning off almost 99.0% from a year ago because it had to offload tons of inventory it had accumulated that nobody wanted. The business phrase you're looking for there is it had to sell a whole lot of stuff at a discount. And thus, needless to say, earnings per share came in way below Wall Street expectations. But who exactly is Wall Street, and where do its expectations come from? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Wall Street expectations are made by people. People like this guy.
My name is Arun Sundaram. I'm a senior equity research analyst at CFRA Research.
And he has a list of companies that he keeps tabs on.
Kraft Heinz, General Mills, Procter & Gamble.
It is a pretty long list, actually.
Costco, Kroger, Albertsons.
Anyway, he and thousands of other analysts, there are about 5,000 in the U.S., have to recommend to their clients, buy this stock, hold this stock, or ditch this stock.
We build financial models. We also take into consideration, you know, what management says, what they expect will happen in the future, you know, whether they're optimistic, pessimistic about the future.
Companies will often try and guide analysts on how the company's doing. You could call that transparency. You could call it managing expectations. You could call it marketing. Eric Supiger is a senior research analyst with JMP Securities.
Sometimes management goes a little overboard in terms of their optimism or their conservatism.
The views of thousands of analysts get published in different reports, and that is where we get so-called Wall Street estimates. When companies report each quarter how things actually went, analysts get to see if they were right. Dave Sequeira is chief U.S. market strategist at Morningstar.
Anytime there's a surprise to that, you can see a short-term movement in that stock price, especially when that surprise is to the downside.
So companies and analysts are kind of locked into this ongoing dance of prophecy and reality, and their dance moves are recorded in stock prices. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve released the minutes from its most recent meeting today, the one back at the end of July, three long economic weeks ago. Those minutes do show the Fed ready to keep raising interest rates, as we kind of knew they would. But again, 3 weeks. A whole lot has happened since then, so must attention still be paid? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is on that one.
The Fed minutes, of course, don't talk about new data showing inflation may be starting to ease, but they do tell us about the mood in the room. That's why, for former Fed economist Ann Owen, the minutes can be a real page-turner.
The source of any good drama is conflict. So I find that to be the most interesting thing when there's a hint of disagreement or conflict.
You won't find much of that in today's minutes. The decision to raise interest rates last month was unanimous, and the presidents of various regional Fed banks have been on the speaking circuit, backing up Chair Jerome Powell's insistence the Fed is ready to keep hiking rates. Economist David Beckworth at the Mercatus Center says that unanimity gives Powell extra street cred.
I do think the fact that everyone's together on the same page does give him the ability to help navigate market expectations as economic developments may change.
So the Fed minutes can give us the big picture of Fed dynamics, but Kathy Busjancic of Oxford Economics says there are also little hints in the minutes that tell us what's to come.
What little nuggets or plot twists or changes in symbolism do we need to watch for?
Busjancic looks to see if the Fed is emphasizing specific words, maybe paying attention to the shortage of workers as a driver of inflation. Then there are the things that are pretty clear in today's minutes, like the Fed saying it's committed to getting inflation down to 2%. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, down, downer, downest. Is that a word? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We got some economic data from the Census Bureau this morning, specifically retail sales flat in July from a month earlier, but that is a tad misleading because A, retail sales are measured in dollars and are not adjusted for inflation, and B, gas prices were way down in the period, so for the overall number to be flat had to mean the consumers were still spending right a bunch on other stuff. But how we are spending, especially with inflation being what it is, how we're spending keeps on changing. And we've heard in retailer earnings report after retailer earnings report that one way people are saving money right now is by switching to private label products, store brands, right? Think Walmart's Great Value, Whole Foods is 365. Last year, private label sales were up almost $2 billion. So Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at the growth of store brands and also puts some rumors to rest.
This story starts with a taste test, a sampling of chocolate sandwich cookies, and only one is the real Oreo. Here to do the hard work is my colleague Mary Elseguera.
You gotta have a big cup of milk with Oreos, I feel, because there needs to be enough room for dipping.
While Marielle gets her almond milk ready, let's look at how we got here. How almost every major grocer started making its own copycat Oreos. To do that, we have to go back to the late 70s. Inflation had been raging for more than a decade. The economy was coming out of a recession, and an aisle of misfit foods was growing at grocery stores.
Eagle offers you even greater savings with generics, a new no-frills value choice.
In this commercial, a man is standing next to these bright, yellow, cartoonish-looking cans and boxes labeled beans or dog food. Jan Benedict Steenkamp has written two books on private labels.
It wasn't very attractive, but people were looking for ways how to save money. And for retailers, they were seeing it as a way to meet consumer demand for cheaper products. Neither of the two parties really liked them so much.
For stores, generics screamed low quality, and shoppers were kind of embarrassed to buy them.
Honestly, you don't feel very good if you have that kind of things in your cart, if you're consuming it. So when good economic times came back, people drifted away from these generics.
Generics almost died out until sometime in the 90s when stores changed their approach and became experts at making copycats. Okay, cookie number one.
I'm pretty sure this is an Oreo.
Wrong, Marielle. This is a Wegmans knockoff. It's high-quality products like this that made generic brands stick and eventually morph into a lifestyle. Think devotees of Aldi and Trader Joe's. Kusum Alawadi is a professor of marketing at Dartmouth.
Often consumers don't think of the Trader Joe's private label as a private label. They think of it as exclusive products that I can't find anywhere.
Generics have evolved so much that we don't even call them generics anymore. Private label is what the industry prefers, which is kind of appropriate because how they're made is very private. mysterious even. Peggy Davies, president of the Private Label Manufacturers Association, says store brands are sometimes manufactured by big brand names that make the original product. And there are lots of theories on the internet about who makes what. Okay, can you debunk some rumors for me? Like, does Grey Goose actually make Kirkland vodka?
Could be, but, you know, Kirkland's not going to tell you who makes it, and Grey Goose isn't going to say they make it.
Grey Goose does not make Kirkland vodka. They sent me a strongly worded email. Kirkland wouldn't tell me who does. I haven't figured out who makes Wegmans Oreos either. Jeff Wishengrad is the vice president of Wegmans brand.
It's not necessarily a supplier that I would want to give a shout out to.
Could it be Oreo? I reached out to its manufacturer and didn't get a response. But this is usually how it goes, and that's a win for both sides. The big manufacturer gets more business and a lower price for its own ingredients because it's buying in bulk, and the store makes money. Wishengrad says more than half of Wegmans sales come from its own brand. Also, store brands can come with bigger profit margins. Christopher Durham, a private label consultant, says they allow retailers to skip the costs that come with running a national brand.
Product development and advertising and marketing and distribution.
And those savings are passed to the consumer. On average, store brands cost 30% less than name brands. But not every consumer is swayed by price alone.
Oh, this is an Oreo.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yes, I knew it.
Okay, but here's the real question. If I tell you the Wegmans cookies are more than a dollar less than the regular Oreos, would that sway you into buying them?
No, probably not. Because it's an indulgence. And so if I'm going to splurge, I might as well get the thing that I really want.
We are emotional buyers. When it comes to Oreos or shampoo or baby formula, our feelings sometimes convince us the dupe is not as good as the real thing. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
You're going to hear in about, what, 2, maybe 2.5 minutes? That this was not a great day on the NASDAQ. The tech-heavy NASDAQ is the usual branding. Apple was the very lonely bright spot, up 0.8% or so. And I mention that because earlier this week, reports Bloomberg, Apple laid off about 100 contract-based recruiters. Meta, Amazon, which the rules say I have to tell you here is an underwriter of this program, Alphabet, Microsoft, and a bunch of others have let it be known that they are slowing down on hiring as well. Marketplace's Justin Ho is on tech for us today.
Up until this year, tech companies have been doing a lot of hiring. That's in part because the pandemic created a lot of demand for their products and services. Dan Ives is managing director at Wedbush Securities.
During the pandemic, the strong got stronger in tech, from an e-commerce, everyone sitting at home streaming, to software, to cloud.
But that started to change, depending on the type of tech company we're talking about, says JP Gounder at Forrester Research.
There are companies that legitimately have performance problems. There are companies that are simply being a little bit cautious and slowing things down.
Gounder says Netflix, for instance, is grappling with new competition, so it laid off about 450 employees. Other companies are worried about where the economy's headed, so they're slowing down hiring.
In an environment of economic uncertainty, even big companies will say, hey, let's wind down this particular part of our business because it's not successful, and we expect it to be even less successful if the economy slows.
Tech companies might also be expecting other businesses to slow down their spending. In other words, advertising revenue, says Carolina Milanese, a tech analyst with Creative Strategies.
Any social media platform or content platform, advertising is usually one of the things that companies kind of pull back on.
And after the hiring boom in tech over the last few years, Milanese says we should expect that pace to slow down. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coming up,
completely evaporating ink from the paper.
Gone just like magic. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 171 today, about 0.5%, 33,980. The NASDAQ down 164 points, 1.25%, 12,938. The S&P 500 down 31.7%, 42.74. Justin was looking at tech, so we head over to Apple, polished up 0.8%, as I said. Meta unplugged 2.5%. Microsoft decreased about 0.25%. Amazon dropped off 1.8%. Today, as Sabri was telling us, it is all about expectations. Target off 2.6%, as we told you, they did not meet those expectations. Today, Lowe's, well, they beat, up more than 0.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus rose up to 2.90%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Screen time. The bane, one of them anyway, of parents everywhere. I mean, you got to get the kids off their phones, right? Because those kids, they just don't get it, how damaging all that online living can be. Well, hang on, because what if you asked teenagers about adolescent digital living to see what they, you know, actually think about it? Researchers at Harvard did just that, and they wrote it all up in a new book called Behind Their Screens, What Teens Are Facing and Adults Are Missing. Emily Weinstein was one of the co-authors. Emily, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So when you're out about town or talking to people or whatever, and they say to you, so what do you do? And you say, I study, teens and screen use. What do they say?
Usually they say, ugh, I know, it's so bad. It's so bad. I'm so glad it didn't exist when I was growing up.
That's so funny because that's the thrust of the book, but it's not the thrust of the book. Those aren't the lessons that you want people to be taken away.
And I think that's why we were so eager to write this book, because we have spent the last few years doing research with more than 3,500 teenagers. And the stories that they were telling us not only stopped us in our tracks, but they made us rethink our own assumptions. And we realized that so much of what adults assume teens are facing or assume it's like to be a teenager today actually misses the mark.
Well, say more about that, right? Because look, I've my oldest kids are now no longer teenagers, but I got a couple who still are, and I'm reasonably sure that they think that I have no clue.
There's a long list. Cyberbullying, for example. Cyberbullying is on a lot of adults' radars, but a lot of what's hard for teens about social dynamics actually falls in the category of more ambiguous or subtle jabs, things that adults wouldn't consider cyberbullying. So teens told us about things like being strategically cropped out of a group photo from a social event, or being the only one in a group picture who doesn't get tagged. Teens told us that they feel like adults really misunderstand that a lot of what's emotionally hard doesn't meet the strict criteria of bullying or the kinds of explicit issues that most adults are worried about.
So as we, well, look, I'm going to get to the social media companies here in a bit, right? Because I do think we have to talk about those just in terms of responsibility. There are a couple of things to talk about just with the teenagers themselves. And number one is not all digital life is bad, right? I mean, there are some things that kids get from being on their phones that are net positives.
Absolutely. And it is, I think, one of the things that we took away so clearly from doing this research is that this landscape is complicated. If it was all bad for all kids all the time, it would be much easier in some ways to figure out what the interventions would be. And it would just be, okay, let's get these kids off of social media. Right. But for some kids, on balance, there are, the positives are so meaningful, whether it's for social connection and support, for learning about things that they really care about, especially during the pandemic. I think so much of this was amplified during a really isolating time.
So there's another thing, actually, that we have to talk about, which is obviously huge, but it strikes differently, right? If you're a girl, teenage girl online versus if you're a teenage boy online, right?
Yeah, and for girls especially, I mean, the idea of being a good friend and what it means to be a good friend, I mean, I think a lot of us think about these gender differences and we immediately go to things like body image, which for sure is a biggie. But there are also other kinds of challenges. The reality of more widespread mental health issues among teens is that teens are seeing posts from others that are crying out for help. And especially if you're an empathetic teen, puzzling over whether and when and how to respond is really hard. We tell a story in the book about a 15-year-old who just watched a classmate's Snapchat post go from a little bit concerning to hinting at suicidal thinking, and then all of a sudden very explicit. And she was behind her phone struggling to figure out what the right move was, whether she should tell someone, who should she tell, what was the right move.
It has to be pointed out here that TikTok and Snapchat and all the rest of them are for-profit enterprises whose very existence depends on the infinite scroll, more time on screen, social sharing, and all of that stuff. How does a 15-year-old girl in Southern California fight that?
Oh, it's too much of a burden for sure on the shoulders of a 15-year-old girl to just regulate their own habits. I think, you know, we talk a lot about ways that adults can be supportive and things that teens can do, but it's just essential that we shift to a place where youth well-being is being consistently prioritized ahead of profits at these companies. And we really need all of the different social media companies, the big players now, but frankly, the new ones that are not yet even on teens' radars, but will become their focal apps over the next year or two. We need to have norms that all of those companies are held to similar standards.
You know, that's a really good point about the ones we don't even know about yet, right? Because this stuff changes so fast.
We are chasing such a moving target, yeah, trying to run research, yeah, in this space. I mean, when we started doing the very first wave of this research, we weren't even talking about TikTok. Of course, now we're talking about TikTok all the time. But over the last few months, we've been talking about Be Real a lot, too. So it's a moving target.
Wow. I don't even know what Be Real is, but something for me to learn. Emily Weinstein and her co-author, Carrie James, their new book is called Behind Their Screens, What Teens Are Facing and Adults Are Missing. Emily, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Kai, thanks so much for having me.
All right, let's go from screens to what came before. And what came before screens, of course, was paper. And paper, if you stop to think about it, is not only not really very green, it's almost anti-green, what with all the chopping down of trees and moshing up of wood fibers. And that sure sounds to me, at least, like an industry ripe for disruption. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
Clearing for agriculture is the biggest cause of deforestation, but, says Cecilia Alcareza of the World Wildlife Fund Conservation Group, the pulp and paper industry and its consumers must shoulder some of the blame.
Every single paper that we use has an environmental and also a social impact all over the world.
From the trees felled and transported to the coal and gas-fired processing of pulp, the paper industry emits a staggering 1 billion tons of carbon a year. And as climate mitigation expert Julian Allwood told the BBC, there's no sign of the paper industry slowing down.
Amazingly, demand for paper is still going up. After 50 years of talking about the paperless office, we haven't got there. So we could change that by changing the amount of paper and packaging that we're all using.
Technology to the rescue. Here's a device that could cut the amount of paper we're all using.
This is our deep printer in action. Deep print laser processing actually at work.
That's Barak Yekutieli, chairman of Reap Technologies, an Israeli firm that's developed a machine that deprints or deletes the printed word.
removing, completely evaporating ink from the paper that is going through the deprinter and without any damage to the paper.
The paper has been coated beforehand to ensure that the ink doesn't sink too deeply into it. Once the laser has burned off the ink, the text simply disappears.
What we end up here is actually a completely blank sheet of paper. There is no trace of any ink on the sheet whatsoever.
And that, says his wife and the company's co-founder, Margalit Yekutieli, will offer their customers the ultimate in paper recycling.
They can use it and reuse it again and again and be environmental friendly.
Reap says it can reprint text on the same piece of paper up to 10 times and eventually 20, 50, perhaps even 100 times. Given the huge saving of paper, Barak Yekutieli says his so-called circular printing will be much cheaper than the conventional process. Oh, and it'll help save the planet too.
Reap can achieve a 90% or more reduction in the CO2 and the consumption of resources.
The challenge will be keeping the same sheet of paper in good condition after it's been reprinted and handled 10 times, let alone 50 or 100. But Yekutieli is confident deprinting represents an historical turning point.
For the first time since the invention of paper and printing, this is a breakthrough for the print and paper industries in that it creates a sustainable usage model.
He's planning to launch a circular printing service next year, aiming it at businesses and governments. One day he might license the technology, the ultimate dream, to have a printer and deprinter combined sitting next to every computer. Could the polluting paper industry be about to turn over a new leaf? At the European Desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, ticker symbol MANU on the New York Stock Exchange, up 6.8% today because Elon Musk decided to make a funny last night. The guy who runs Tesla and who may or may not, I guess, own Twitter at some point, tweeted last night that he was going to buy the storied English Premier League soccer team Manchester United. And then, like an hour later, tweeted that he was only kidding, as Elon Musk does. It's an insult to injury thing for the club, really. Two games into the season over there, they are at the bottom of the table, and they are going to get trampled by Liverpool on Monday. Okay, we are out of here, but first, your moment of economic context, courtesy Her Majesty's Office of National Statistics, which said this morning inflation over in the UK is running at 10.1% over the past 12 months, rising food prices the biggest culprit. Just by way of comparison, in the minutes of last month's Fed meeting that Nancy Marshall-Genzer was telling us about, best guesses for headline inflation here for all of 2022, the Fed's favorite measure, which is, of course, personal consumption expenditures, PCE, expected to be 4.8%. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostedt, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.